Accession number 28750, Reel 7.
Laurie Manton, Reel 7. Before we leave the Gulf, Laurie, could I ask you about Gulf War syndrome? You know, you've mentioned all the jabs and the tablets you took. Do you have any experience at all of this?
No, I've thought a lot about it. I have to say my time spent in the desert was the most fit I've ever felt in all my life, even as a young man. I think primarily because of the simpleness of the life. You were up and dressed before dawn in case there was some sort of attack. They call it stand to, and they even did that in the First World War trenches. Everyone was ready for first light. And then you went about your job, and they had regular meal times, and you had your meals. But as soon as it got dark, and bear in mind it's winter, you couldn't show any lights, so everyone went to sleep. So lights are out at 6 o'clock until 5 the next morning. Now, whether it's that, because you slept all right, but felt full of vitality, never before ever in my life and never since. But I was personally concerned about the effects of Gulf War syndrome. And I did a lot of research, certainly on the American documentation that's available through their National Archive. So I spent 2 or 3 years sort of researching Gulf War syndrome. And indeed, I'd started getting various analogy, which if I took certain foodstuffs would start to close up my my throat, which can be quite alarming. So I went to, because Frome in Somerset, near where I live, is like the second best alternative capital of the UK, whereas Totnes is the best. I went to a stress clinic there where they did an allergy test, and they found a great deal of things that I was allergic to. One being to one of the ingredients of malaria tablets, which I didn't take in the Gulf but had taken on other foreign trips. I was allergic to substances derived from crude oil, and yet I've exposed to the oil clouds and the burning oil fields. And there were a number of things like this of which I developed an allergy against. And they gave me various homeopathic tablets I took to offset this. With except for one or two little concerns which didn't develop, then touch wood, I haven't had my throat closing since the visit to the clinic, but they were very interested in my case because a lot of the allergies could be traced to my military service in the Gulf. And I was further perturbed then when they were doing more work on the Gulf War syndrome to see that the anti-malarial insect spray they used inside the trenches of an evening in the British Army bases, the tented camps, was a quite deadly chemical. And yet you'd be in the tent and they shove this big pipe in the door and the whole thing would fill with the fumes of this cancer-inducing drug. But although I'm not physically ill with Gulf War syndrome, I feel there's an underlying sort of thing there. And having seen the MOD is about to stop offering its depleted uranium testing opportunity, I just in the last week applied to have the test carried out.
Have you met many people with it who say that they have got Gulf War syndrome?
a number of people. It's difficult because some of them it could be stress related, but others it's very definitely some sort of major allergy which has set them back into what they're doing. But I think Sean Rusling, the first Gulf War veteran to be, they decided he had Gulf War syndrome. He's definitely affected by post-traumatic stress and by various illnesses that has affected too. But so many of them have died as a result. You know, I believe there is something in it. But I'm still here at the moment.
Yes, will you stay here? You're now going to tell me, I think, about the your return to the area, are you?
Yeah, having got back to the UK, I had 3 weeks off. Well, if you served in the army or anywhere else, then you had several weeks leave. I just went back to the office in Aldershot because they're miserable so-and-sos and I was expected to work, so I didn't get a break. But I remember over that sort of three-week period, unusually, because I used to rush around a bit hyperactive. I just wanted to sit on a chair in the patio watching the clouds go by in the sky. So it slowed me down and I just wanted to look at things rather than rush about. But then the opportunity came up to go see the Kurds in northern Iraq. Now, right from the moment I got back to the UK from the Gulf, every night there was pictures on the telly of little old ladies in bare feet struggling through the snow over the mountain passes in northern Iraq. And like most people serving in and attached to the British forces, we all felt the war had been stopped too soon. It didn't finish the job. And so every night watching the news, I used to cry, because I felt guilty by association, even though I wasn't a soldier. So I was quite pleased to get the opportunity to go out there and find out that things had improved. But it was, in a way, it was slightly more restrictive in the ability to move around, because Turkey was involved, and they're traditionally a difficult area to operate in. Because they're awkward.
Did you have to go via Turkey? You had to get in that
way,
did you?
Yeah, we were actually a place called Incirlik, Incirlik. There was a Turkish air base, of which the American and British forces created an airhead. So that was, if you like, the staging post, the gathering point, and then people would be pushed forward into Iraq, do their business, come back, others would go in from there. But right from the start, I thought, this is going to be really different. We arrive, we're thrown off the aircraft, put in on a grassy area next to the runway, and a guy comes out and says, right, there's a few things you should know. In the Turkish army, every officer is allowed to shoot a handful of people every year without any inquiry whatsoever. So if they find the Turkish soldier asleep on guard duty, he just shoots him, kills him. So that's the way they operate. Don't argue with them. So, and the other thing is, if you see a big centipede, and we're talking big centipede, run for your life, because it's a really venomous bite. So I go off and find the local, or the British military PR setup, which is being run by Royal Marines. So I arrived up there with my kit on my back, in a rucksack, in my uniform, all ready to go. And they said, "We can't stay with us," which we always have done in the past. "We're going up into Iraq. Tough, get lost, go away." So off they went, and we stood by the side of the road. But ever clever, and knowing that if you want to get on with wherever you're visiting, you make friends of the quartermaster, because he owns all the kit, and the motor transport officer, because he owns all the vehicles, I thought, Commando Logistics Squadron, which was remaining there. Logistics, that's provided by the Army, who have done the commando course. So I went along and saw them and said, really stuck, been abandoned. And they said, "Here's a camp bed, here's a cooker, here's your rations, here's a tent, go and live with the lads." So that was sorted out. There was a communal toilet, and you know, I think, oh, he's mentioning the toilet again.
Here we go again.
This was definitely conservation inducing. In fact, I didn't go to the toilet. I was desperate to go to the toilet. And it was a mile down the road. And when you walked a mile down the road, you went through a Hessian screen into this area where the proper toilets were, i.e. they were thunder boxes, the wooden boxes with a hole in, on a raised dais. And in there was the equivalent of a American black American football team. These huge black soldiers, all, and they were, these thunder boxes were in a circle. So I would have been sat behind these guys who were 10 foot wide and 8 foot tall, who were animalistic. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to the toilet in there. And that was the only toilet for miles around, so that quite put me off. I think I would have preferred the spade and the hole I had in Iraq, because there are limits and it's very inhibited. But it's probably something that people who have served the forces don't mention very often, but it's something to bear in mind that it can have an impact on your life. We then managed to get ourselves into what was part of the RAF area. Now, the RAF, they're wonderful. They arrive with their caterers and everything, and there is never any problem for them whatsoever. They're full of the comforts of life. There's no hardship. They don't deliberately make things hard for themselves. And they were producing the most marvellous meals. So we got a tent allotted to us. Went and had the meal, lovely salad and such like. In the middle of the night, I woke up and I couldn't stop shaking. And then I was violently ill. And I got very bad food poisoning. And they were warned before they went out there not to use local salad, these RAF chefs, because the Turks use human waste as fertiliser. So it gave ever such a lot of people very bad food poisoning. So I sort of semi-recovered. And then I got a lift across the border into Iraq with the commandos. I arrived in this sort of ruined village. Went in there, shown a bit of floor to put my camp bed up on and my sleeping bag, and I went in to interview the commanding officer. And I thought, oh gosh, I feel ill. And the sergeant major came to his office and opened the door, and just at the moment I turned my head, and I suffered from projectile vomiting, which went ever such a long way through the door, at head height, right across the room and on the other side, which shows how ill I was. They carried me to my camp bed and laid me on it, and people kept trampling over me to get to the other offices because they couldn't give a damn that I was ill or not. And I recovered a bit more, and we went round and saw some of the refugee camps where the Kurds were, which were very organised, very neat. And I felt a lot better about this. I thought, well, this is good because, you know, they're being rescued. Well, then a day later, the truth came home to me because I was then taken to see a hospital that was being run by Canadian medics. And we got into the hospital. And as we arrived, there were a procession of medics were carrying children from sort of baby age to 8 or 9 in their arms round the back of the building and laying them down in the grass. And I said, you know, what's going on there? They won't live. Free up the beds, we're lying them there and they'll die eventually. And this was terrible, say the least. And I had a different photographer with me, Mike. And then all the sick Kurds would come to the locked gates of the hospital, and it was this poor responsibility of a female nursing officer from the Canadian Army to jump up on one of the pillars of the main post and point to the people she felt were most in need of medical attention. And my photographer and I were just going through all our stuff and handing over our rations for these people. And there was a girl there who had a hand through a hole in the fence who was just rubbing her tummy like that. Had these very expressive eyes, which Mike photographed, and that was used as a link throughout the articles we did, you know, her terrible face. And then Mike saw a guy who looked very elderly, Iraqi, who was obviously seriously ill, who looked just like his father, and that finished him because his father was dying at that time. And that was it was really guilt-ridden. And then this astonishing Kurdish guy, he almost looked like a Pathan tribesman from the northwest frontier of India, very proud, very majestic. And he was walking along like this, head held high. I was a little bundle, like a little small rug. And there was bare feet sticking out of one side and the hair out the other. And it was his 4-year-old daughter who just died, and he was taking her off to bury. So that was, you know, utterly horrendous, seeing that. But then I think that was because the people, it was either the children who were being laid down at the back, who were sobbing and crying, who were dying and just being left to die. The selection process of, you know, you'll live, you'll live, you'll live, the rest of you, tough, we can only deal with 10 today. Desperation on the face of the others, as opposed to dead bodies, which are nothing, you know, the soul's gone and that's it. So that was deeply difficult, and that's always remained with me.
Yes. Why was this? Was there such a shortage of aid and aid agencies there?
Well, there are hardly any aid agencies there. In the camp, it was fine, but there were no medical facilities there. And you've got to remember, it's the sort of early days. Their lot had been improved because they had the exclusion zone so declared, which I think was John Major's idea, which meant that any Iraqi forces trying to get in to attack the Kurds would then be destroyed by aircraft and such like. But you've got all these starving and ill people and not the infrastructure to offer them any succour. A very unfortunate situation to be in like that. But I felt sicker and sicker. And after 2 weeks, I just felt so dreadful. And we pulled out and went back to the airbase. And I mooched around a bit, spoke to various people. And then I had a chance to go off with some raw Marines who were going to meet with Peshmerga guerrillas up in the mountains. And these were the Kurdish guerrillas that were fighting against Saddam Hussein's forces. And they were the real, you know, sort of fighting people. And I always remember in this helicopter, and we went up the side of this cliff, and there was an Iraqi anti-aircraft gun with its crew there, right next to us on the cliff, you know, the gun barrel length. And they were surprised to see us. We were definitely surprised to see them, because they shouldn't have been in the country, and we just went by, and I'm sure they were sorted out later. That was a nasty moment. And we had a guerrilla chief with us, who was showing us how to get to the rendezvous point. But he'd never flown before. Why would he? So he'd never seen the terrain from the air. Anywhere on the ground, he would have known where he was by the scenery. So we come along and we sort of balance with one wheel of the aircraft on the edge of a cliff, because it's a narrow plateau. Everyone pile out, all the Marines with their guns taking up position, and he'd come out and he'd go, "No, this isn't it." Back on the aircraft, sort of flop away from the cliff, and eventually he found the road which led to the air. He said, "Oh, no, that is." And such like. The helicopter landed in this clearing in the wood. Everyone got out, the helicopter flew away, thinking, "This is very strange." And out of the undergrowth rose up all around us, all them Peshmerga guerrillas who were hidden in the long grass and the leaves, which was a big shock as well. And then they linked up with the Marines, and we wandered around a bit with them. And there was another helicopter coming by, so we jumped on that and then flew back again. It's unfortunate that those are really the only things I remember, because for the rest of my 2 to 3 weeks there, I just felt so ill and nauseous and all the time. And although I wanted to stay there longer, I felt that there's no point, I'm just so ill. And I just wanted to crawl up the ramp at the back of a Hercules and fly off to Cyprus and then back to the UK. So I arranged we'd get on the Hercules that evening. And we're walking out to the aircraft with our rucksacks and such like. And this Turkish soldier stood between us and the aircraft, and he said, "Stop." He said, "We're getting on the aircraft." He says, "No, go away or I'll kill you." And cocked his rifle. So I asked him where his officer was, and he pointed over the tent. And I went over and I said, "You know, I don't appreciate someone threatening to kill me. I just need to get on the aircraft. You can only get on the aircraft if you travel by vehicle." So in my sixth state, I had to then walk a mile or so back to our lines, put the stuff in the back of a vehicle. There was no room for me, so I had to hang on the outside of the back of the Land Rover. And we got round there, threatened to be killed again, because I wasn't in the vehicle. So we had to back off, find some way of getting me in the vehicle, and then got out to the plane, and I was sort of carried up the steps and flew back to Cyprus, and a couple of days later got a flight back to the UK, still feeling very miserable. But, you know, those were the sort of highlights of the...
Yes, yes, these Kurds, you were saying... you'd seen the pictures on TV of these people going up on the mountainside.
Yeah, trying to
Is
get to
safe
areas.
People?
Yeah, the mountain. Yeah. They'd come out of the mountains and then started coming into the camps.
Mm-hmm.
But then you already had a population in those areas near the camps and the towns and villages. You know, and there was no lighting, no power, no sewage system. No hospital, really, no medical supplies, only what the troops could spare. So they were still in a desperate safe state, but they weren't being murdered by Saddam Hussein's forces, which made it easier to bear. But I think anyone who's in the first Gulf War is still really uneasy at the stupidities of, you know, our leaders deciding to call off the war when they could have just gone to Baghdad and, you know, sorted it out.
It was a surprise for everyone, do you think, when, you know, George Bush did announce the end of the war. It certainly was here, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Stunned amazement, because the, you know, they suddenly turn around at that stage and says, well, the only reason we were here was to free Kuwait. Well, you've left him there, and then abandoned people like the Marsh Arabs and all the people that rose up and said, help, help. And no help came, and they all got murdered. You know, it's,
but you didn't go to that area at all, did you, the
no.
Marsh?
No.
That which would be the area where the British troops are today, I think, down in the Basra, wouldn't it?
Sort of around that, around the area. A couple of photographer friends, you know, who weren't connected with the British forces, unilateralists, went out that way and were arrested by the Iraqis, even though the war was over and lost all their equipment and such like. And I think there was, a big battle between American and Iraqi forces after the Gulf War had ended. Some days afterwards, they came across each other, and the Iraqis didn't surrender. So there was a shootout there.
Yeah, this sort of illustrates. You were saying earlier how, in the desert, you felt so good.
Mm.
And were able to do your job, and yet this was seen to be just the opposite.
Mm. Well, it's interesting, because just having a quick think about the technology at that time. When I was reporting in the desert, I had a portable typewriter, and I typed my stories. And they should have been